ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, it's The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and I'm in the studio today with Lolita Emmanuel at the piano. Sounds a bit different to the last time we had the piano on The Music Show. You'll hear more of what she does with the instrument and also when she needs to move beyond it later on today's show. Lolita describes herself as an artistic researcher. She's a musician, a storyteller, and an academic, and she's moments away from finishing her Doctor of Musical Arts. She's also part of this year's ABC Top 5 early career researchers in the arts who've come to Radio National to make shows about their work. Lolita's involved in what she calls creative reassembly. Reassembly because she's a Syrian, and a Syrian culture, though thousands of years old, has been fragmented by historical ethnic cleansing, dispossession, and dispersal. So you could say Lolita's work is grounded in Assyrianness, and through sound and story and this process of creative reassembly, she's building cultural resilience, strengthening cultural memory, and she's hoping to empower Assyrian artists and voices around the world. She's a pianist, singer, and composer, and she works with other Assyrian artists, including the filmmaker Dicky Barto and the musicians Susan Eskander and Nuri Iskander. More of them and other Assyrian musicians working with cultural memory throughout today's music show. Lolita, welcome to the show.
Hello, it's nice to see you in person.
Well, let's start with you and your background and how you came to write the thesis. I mean, I realise it's actually an enormous topic in itself.
Yeah. I came to this project at a time where I was really kind of searching for my artistic and cultural voice. I have a background that is full of different things. I am Assyrian and Armenian, and I also was trained in classical piano. And my experience with music for a very long time had been quite compartmentalized. I had my classical training in piano, but at home I was listening to Armenian and Assyrian music, and I was going to traditional events and things like weddings with my Assyrian community where we danced to Assyrian music. And that was a big part of who I was, but I really struggled to bring that to the piano for a couple of reasons. Yeah, you're nodding, you're like, yep.
I mean, so many of the things that you hear in Assyrian music, you cannot do on a piano, can you?
That's right, that's right. And I think, yeah, like I said, there's two reasons, you know, it's very much about the voice. Like, Assyrian music is rooted in the beautiful emotional resonance of the voice, as well as the philosophical or symbolic meaning of the voice, which is in storytelling and agency. And in classical music, for a very long time, a performer's voice was very tightly controlled. You know, self-expression was not really possible for classical performers. Of course, there have been incredible movements by performers to really push back against that idea, but I think in my training, that was still very much ingrained. There's also this idea that the composer is the real storyteller and the performer is just their mouthpiece. That didn't sit right with me, especially when I wanted to start playing Assyrian music and I was looking for music for my instrument and found that a lot of the music was written by non-Assyrian composers who made some pretty orientalist depictions of who we were and also didn't really make music that resonated with me or my community. And so I thought, well, you know, it doesn't feel right to be the mouthpiece for this kind of music. And I wanted to really expand beyond that. The other reason is just the piano not being a very popular instrument in Assyrian music for many reasons. One is that Assyrian music is quite modal and microtonal and focused on all the beautiful, flexible aspects of the voice. It's full of melisma, and all the microtonality emerges in all the vocal techniques. And the piano having this mechanism that is quite fixed and percussive, it confines those sounds actually between those keys.
We'll come back to this and find out how you have got around it because you have. But maybe for people listening who are thinking, where is Assyria? You know, because you look on a map, it's not there, is it?
Yeah. And I think this is like my life story and probably the life story of many Assyrians. We often have to go through this explanation. You know, when you hear the word Assyria, people probably think of the ancient Assyrian Empire, which is in what people call in the Western world Mesopotamia. Assyrians, we call that in our language Beth Naharen, which is the land between two rivers. And, you know, that's our indigenous land, which spans present-day northern Iraq, south and southeast Turkey, northwestern Iran, and northeast Syria. But, you know, because of us living through various empires like the Ottoman Empire and also the rise of modern nation states, we've been divided across borders. And then to top that off, we've experienced repeated genocides that has fragmented and displaced our community across borders. So while we're living there, that's our indigenous homelands, we actually have more Assyrians living around the world than in our homelands.
So where would you say your homeland is?
So, you know, we have different villages and ways of identifying with that. So my dad is Marbushnaya, which is a village in southeast Turkey, in Hakkari. My mum, she's Armenian and Assyrian. Her Assyrian heritage is in Urmia, which is now in Iran. That's also been a big part of how I understand myself. My parents were always telling me, you know, never forget who you are. Always, you know, remember where you come from. And I think that comes from a legacy of erasure that's happened in the Middle East, where Assyrians have been erased from that history, even though we have a really ancient presence there.
Yes. What about language?
Yeah. So we speak Sureth, that's how we say it in our language. Sureth or Suret, that's a modern form of Mesopotamian Aramaic. So it's one of the oldest continuing languages in that region.
So how much like the Aramaic of, say, biblical times would it be? Or has it been modernized in the same way that English has in the last 2,000 years?
Well, yeah, like many languages, it's evolved over time and also as a reflection of the journey that we've all gone through as a transnational people. But our liturgical language, which is Syriac, is quite close. But the Mesopotamian Aramaic that we speak has a really heavy Akkadian influence, which is what was the lingua franca of the ancient Assyrian Empire. We have different ways of identifying as well. Some people identify with their churches. That might be the Chaldean Catholic Church or the Syriac Orthodox Church.
So because the empire was so big and covered so many different parts of what you would broadly call the Middle East, presumably there are lots and lots of different sorts of music. I mean, there isn't one thing.
That's right. Often when I talk to people about Assyrian music, I like to give them a poetic answer. You know, I think I'll give you my poetic answer now. Mm. Assyrian music is really a rich, rich tapestry of diverse expressions. And, you know, the main fabric of that is rooted in our ancient connection to that land, and I think we can see that in the expressions that come out of the church, but also our pagan and secular traditions that are a reflection of that ancient connection there. And then the threads that weave through that tapestry are a reflection of the sounds and stories that move through the lands that we lived on, and also the sounds that we experienced as we move through different lands because of displacement.
And so there's regional differences as well.
That's right. I think that's really important to talk about because it's a beautiful thing to celebrate. It would be unfair to pin Assyrian music down to just one essential sound. And that's unfortunately a tendency in most places, but what I've seen in a Western context where there's this residual attitude towards racial purity, you know, where there's this need to understand, like, what's the essential sound? You know, what is the pure sound that defines a people or a nation?
You want to get a handle on it, don't you?
That's right. So, there's this obsession with certainty. I want to pin this down.
That's right. That's right. Well, we're not going to be doing any of that today. We're just going to be dipping our toes in here and there.
Yeah.
Perhaps we could come back to you and the piano, and we're going to hear a piece from your lecture recital film at the Palace of Ashurbanipal. Tell us about this and tell us about the palace as well.
Oh, yes. Just to give you some context around this project, you know, my whole project was about trying to bring Assyrianness to the piano, you know, because of the challenges that I had described before. And This particular work was in an experiment that I was doing with storytelling. You know, Assyrians have a rich storytelling tradition. You know, we have a bardic tradition as well that we continue, but also a use of music where we express who we are and we also speak back to powers that have tried to deny our heritage. And that's a kind of feeling and way of making Assyrian music that I wanted to bring to this. So at the Palace of Ashurbanipal, that was a composition commissioned by an Assyrian pianist in the US for a festival called Pop-Up Palmyra, which happened after the ISIS destruction of Assyrian artifacts in Mosul.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was absolutely devastating because that was also a time where Assyrians were, well, there was a genocide against Assyrians and minority groups in that region, like Yazidis as well. So that, coupled with seeing artifacts that hold so much resonance for us and it's so important to our cultural memory, was just horrifying. So this festival, the idea behind this commissioning was to engage with that idea and try to recover or engage with the past after it's been destroyed. Expressing Assyrianness at the piano is so complicated because I don't have a voice in the same way that a singer might or a violinist might. And, you know, you can reach so many people with that. And so I wanted to experiment with visual art. And I met an incredible, incredible Assyrian artist in the US who's now my great friend, Dicky Bato, who works with a very similar idea that I do, which is how do we continue culture and how do we make sense of ourselves when our culture has been destroyed and broken into pieces. He had taken propaganda footage that was made by ISIS when they were destroying those artifacts. It was so incredible. I was just amazed when I saw it. He had remixed it and taken that footage into a beautiful expression and reclamation of Assyrian identity. You know, ISIS might be able to destroy these artifacts, but they can't take away our persistence and our resilience in connecting with those. So performance in this context was a really important way for me and Assyrians to connect with cultural memory. And in this case, it was those artifacts.
Thank you.
that's at the palace of Ashurbanipal, performed by Lalita Emanuel, who's my guest on today's music show. And that's from the lecture recital film, which you can find on YouTube. Watch yourself. Let's talk then about the limits of the piano. We've sat you here at a lovely big black shiny Bösendorfer, which we're very proud of, and had tuned specially for you, and you've come in and done things to it, haven't you?
Yes, I've thrown things into it, but I came in and I was like, do they know that I'm about to break this apart?
You've retuned it.
yes. Well, I am using this new invention, and this kind of came at a time in my project where I really wanted to experiment with Assyrian, or sounds that really resonated with Assyrians. And it's an invention called the makiano. If people know the word makam, that's like a commonly used modal tradition in the Middle East. And it's one that Assyrians commonly use as well. And it's a combination with makam and piano that makes up the invention, makiano.
Yes, I see.
Yes. So it's basically a portable microtuner for the piano that allows you to flexibly tune the strings. And this was like so exciting for me because I finally had the opportunity to unlock all these sounds that, you know, reminded me of home, that reminded me of Assyrianness. I'm quite new to it as well, I should say. Modal traditions and makam it's a completely different world. And, you know, being trained in a Western classical tradition on an equally tempered piano means that I have to get my head around sounds that, yes, I've heard growing up, but sounds that I now have to produce out of this essentially percussive instrument. So do you want to hear what it sounds like?
Yes.
Okay. So just to tell you how it works, it's basically a bunch of magnetic weights that we put onto the strings of the piano, and that basically pitches those sounds up.
Because it applies pressure.
That's right.
So it's a bit like, you know, if you press a string on a violin or a guitar.
Yeah.
And you so the pitch goes up.
Yes, yeah, right. It's shortening the speaking length of the strings when you put that pressure on there. So I've put it on, and I will say that this is a new invention and I'm still learning how to use it. So you might hear some interesting sounds. So this little clangy sound, it's part of the reason why this new invention was so, yes, it was really exciting for me, but incredibly painful. Makiano basically, currently it's on these strings, but because of the various designs of different pianos, it doesn't necessarily sit comfortably onto those strings. So you're hearing a ringing and a clanging, which is actually kind of cool.
You think it's not intended?
Well, I mean, it probably is. It's probably sounding like this because I'm a novice, but
maybe. But yeah, I think we can get away with telling our listeners that it's exactly how it's supposed to sound.
That's right, actually. Yeah, thank you. No, I mean, what was really exciting actually through this experiment when I was working with a collaborator is we realized that this clanging is kind of like an expression of some of the sounds we hear in Assyrian music as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, like in our church, for example, in some of our churches, it's traditional to use a metallic fan as part of the religious rituals, and that kind of has a really sparkly, shiny effect. So, you know, I'm bringing it to the piano with this makiano.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect. Okay, yeah. I'm completely convinced
Thank
by that.
You. Yeah.
So what does this enable you to play then?
Yeah, the first thing was like, oh my God, I can finally play the sounds that I've heard growing up in our weddings, which is actually one of the few places where we can practice our culture. There's a popular song called Narine, which we often dance to. And I could play that on the piano, which was amazing. I'll sing it first and kind of mimic what it sounds like on the piano. Narine, zmor narine. Narine, zmor narine. Narine, zmor narine. So this is like mind-blowing for me. And just, super exciting because I could finally embody this idea of Assyrianness that for so long I'd been trying to do. But it also, you know, and I'm really sorry to break this to you, Andrew, it also wasn't a perfect solution in every sense. And I think especially that came up with when we were working with, when I say we, I mean me and my collaborator, who's an incredible violinist, when we were working with hymns from the Syriac Orthodox Church, which are so sacred and hold so much significance for many people in our community. You know, there were certain things we could and couldn't do in general because it's so sacred. But working with this Makiano meant we had to really be creative with our solutions. It's not something that worked perfectly.
Well, no. And I mean, in a way, you could come up with something completely new, couldn't you? I'm thinking actually of the blues, because the blue notes in blues are not on the piano keyboard either. They're in the cracks between the notes. But that doesn't mean that there haven't been some great blues piano players, people like Roosevelt Sykes or Tippy Wallace. And they've had to find ways around it, and, you know, by playing the notes either side at the same time, for example. And have come up in the process with a whole new style of blues piano, which is not perhaps original, authentic blues, but nevertheless is a fine thing. So you could presumably do something very similar, particularly with your new device.
That's right. And I think Assyrians have also been doing this and kind of solving similar creative problems for a while because, you know, we've ended up in places where we haven't had traditional instruments or traditional tools for Assyrianness, and we've had to come up with creative solutions. One of the solutions for Assyrian keyboard players is to play on an org, which I like to call the much cooler little cousin of the piano. And it's essentially a synthesizer that allows you to play microtonal sounds and also has all these sustaining capabilities to mimic the voice. And when they're, for example, accompanying singers with chords, what they do is they usually leave the third out of a chord. So instead of playing a triad, or they leave out the third. And so that is in order not to clash with the microtonal sounds that you might play in a melody or sing.
Yeah.
On the piano, I can't get the same kind of like sustaining qualities of the voice, but I can mimic some vocal techniques. You know, in Assyrian vocal music, there's a lot of techniques that resemble things like yodeling. You know, I was singing before, narine, smor narine. And so that's, you know, one way to create that sound. But I think it works best in collaboration with other musicians who might be singing, might have the language, you know, we might be playing instruments that can sustain that. The emotional resonance is what we can get out of the voice that speaks to many Assyrians.
In your lecture recital, you talk about William Daniil.
Well, William Daniil was a prominent Assyrian composer and also a very loved activist in the Assyrian community. He was born in Iran and he was a survivor of the genocide in 1915. Most people know that as the Armenian genocide. Assyrians as well as Yazidis were killed during that time. And, you know, he had grown up in this time where the Ottoman Empire was breaking apart and modern nation states were rising. And there were all these talks about having an autonomous region for Assyrians or expressing an Assyrian national identity. That was so important, I think, if you consider the loss that so many Assyrians went through at that time. And he was really inspired by this movement that was really popular at the time, which was musical nationalism. And that was all about expressing a national identity and a national sound. It's a bit complicated now. It's not so useful to us now because, you know, what we've realized is you can't pin the identity of a diverse people down into one pure sound. And so what he did was he went to Hakkari, which is in southeast Turkey, and he listened to the music of the Hakkari Assyrians there, which he thought was the purest sound. Again, a bit of a complicated thing to say, but he wanted to use that with Western classical music to create this style. The challenge with that is that it doesn't necessarily speak to every Assyrian. It does not necessarily reflect everyone's expression of home. But I think it was his really exciting new way to express Assyrian identity after so much loss at a time where it was really important to express who we were. ¶¶
heard you sing, and you were talking a moment ago about the yodeling effect in vocalizing. What about the different traditions of singing?
There are so many traditions that are rooted in the voice, you know, the sacred traditions in the church, but also many, many secular traditions like rawe. Rawe is this beautiful, beautiful tradition that's about, I think, 200 years old, we can say confidently, probably even extends back into antiquity. It's something that's usually sung in gatherings. It's often about love. As one Assyrian elder described to me once, it's a very naughty Lolita. It's, you know, they talk about desire and sex and love, which is awesome. And it's also about love for our land. What we know about rawe is from the Assyrians of Hakkari, which is in a mountain, in a mountainous region. It's historically been sung in the mountains. And one Assyrian that I spoke to, who is an incredible singer of rawe, described to me that it's a reflection of the sound and the contours of the mountains because it's so melismatic. And it goes up and down like the mountains.
You recorded some when you were in northern Iraq in 2023. Tell us about Nimrod Shmuel.
Yeah, Rabbi Nimrod Shmuel. And I say Rabbi, that's our way of saying teacher or master. It's a term of respect. Rabbi Nimrod Shmuel is an Assyrian from Nala, which is an Assyrian village in northern Iraq. And he is one of the few people who are still carrying on this tradition of rawe. Because we've been displaced so many times and torn away from our home, rawe has gotten harder and harder to sing, you know, because it's so tied to that mountainous context. But he is one of the many Assyrians in Iraq who are finding new ways to continue that tradition. He's teaching his son as well how to sing it. And we just had this amazing chat where he told me about it. He sung so many beautiful songs. Yeah, it was gorgeous.
That's the voice of the Assyrian singer Nimrod Shmuel, a singer of rawe, recorded in 2023 on a field trip to northern Iraq by my guest on today's music show, Lolita Emmanuel. We're talking about Assyrian musical traditions, church hymns. Let's talk about them.
Let's. The vocal tradition in the church is super influential in Assyrian music, and I think it's held in a really sacred regard, of course, because of its spiritual reasons, but also because it's been one of the few vessels and spaces that we've been able to continue our culture, you know, as a minoritized people and a stateless people. One of the things that many Assyrians are really proud of is the way that the Assyrian church traditions, ancient pagan Mesopotamian traditions. You know, for example, there is a poetic genre called disputation poems, a genre in Mesopotamia that was basically like a duel between two people. It was a poetic duel. And in the process of the Christianization of the Assyrian Empire, which is in, you know, the first to the third centuries, they had to make slow changes. It wasn't like take it, take Christianity straight away. They had to slowly adapt. And what that meant was traditional songs and genres were Christianized, essentially, with Christian themes. But the structure and the logic of those traditions remained. You know, some of my fellow Assyrian researchers and I are really interested in this idea of whether our pop songs, which follow a similar duet pattern, are an extension of that tradition.
And do you think they are?
There's so much to learn, possibly. I mean, there's so much, I think, and this is the challenge of being an Assyrian. We often joke about how we have to be like archaeologists and historians and musicologists and all that stuff just to try to understand who we are. And I think I will say, as Assyrian musicians, I like to call us like detectives. We have a very unique role in the community. We're not just people who play music. We are also people who carry our traditions and teach our community the language and also do this really exciting thing that I call transnational joinery. And I'm just thinking of the Japanese mending craft called kintsugi. It's this whole idea of how broken pieces are mended together with this golden glue. Me, I think that Assyrian musicians are that golden glue because it's very common for musicians to be invited to all of our different transnational nodes and parts of the community around the world. And we often sing the same songs to different parts of the community. So we're kind of united sonically through their performances.
Yes. Individual types of songs have functions as well, don't they? Maybe you could say something about lullabies, because they have a function which is rather unusual for a lullaby. It's not just to do with putting a child to sleep.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. There is a big lamenting practice in our traditions, you know, and part of that is tied to the way the church understands this emotional concept of chasha or hasho, which is can be translated as suffering, or it can be translated as passion. And we even have vocal traditions that allow us to process trauma and grief. But the lullabies that you mention have a really interesting history in our community. During the 1915 genocide, many, many Assyrians were sadly suppressed from expressing their grief. And that was because of fear of further persecution. And, you know, mothers, for example, had no choice but to grieve internally or privately. And what happened was, you know, of course, you can't contain all of that grief. What ended up happening was mothers were singing about what they'd seen, literally eyewitness accounts of the genocide, to their children, newborn children, as lullabies to put them to sleep. That's like, it's so intense. It's so devastating because it's literally intergenerational trauma in action. And it's the transmission of that in action. However, something really incredible happened. You know, those children, eventually when they grew up and they ended up in diaspora, they had the opportunity to experience a form of intergenerational healing, basically, through their performances of those same lullabies that they had heard growing up. You know, they converted those songs into protest songs on stage. So songs that were, you know, holding eyewitness accounts of the genocide. They were sung in this lamenting style, but eventually shifted into a really proud and resilient tone. And that was incredibly healing for us. So it's lamenting in that tradition. It's allowed us to process grief and like feel all the feels, but also it's allowed us to experience resilience.
On today's music show, my guest is Lolita Emmanuel, and we are talking about Assyrian music traditions. On a happier note, there's butter churning songs.
Oh, yes, butter churning. That's right. Yeah, we have work songs, again, that also reflect our connection to our land. And for a long time, especially in mountainous regions, our songs were a reflection of our agricultural lifestyle. So one song is Gudi, which literally refers to a butter churner made out of a goat.
That's a surprising bit.
Yeah?
That the churns are goats.
Yes. To be honest, it is, in my view, one of the most iconic representations of sustainability, Indigenous sustainability in action. It was a really crafty use of the goat. Of course, the goat would be milked and the milk would become butter. But how we did that was by basically breaking the goat up into pieces. You know, we would eat the meat and the goat would be disassembled into a vessel. So the bones would be like the tripod, basically, that would hold up a goat skin vessel. It would be sewn into, you know, this churn, essentially, and buttermilk would be poured into that. And women traditionally would be doing this practice and singing along to the sound of the butter churn rocking back and forth. So to pass time, they sing the song Gudi.
It's interesting. I mean, we've talked before on this show to musicians from the Balkans who do turn their goats into bagpipes, and it's not that dissimilar in terms of the technique involved. And you could conceivably churn butter in a set of bagpipes, I suppose, couldn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Same sort of thing.
I'm telling you, it's really purposeful. It's a very crafty use. And I think actually, you know, you mentioned Balkan traditions. I think this is a reflection of how so many communities around the world find ways to be creative with whatever tools that they have around them.
Yeah. We heard an example there of Gordi sung by Samira Salomon. But we can also hear the Mesopotamian fusion version. What's going on here? This is kind of closer to what you're doing, really, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, this band was one of the first bands that I discovered and was really inspired by at the very beginning of my research. Their vision was to take these traditional songs and create new expressions of them. And I think what was so powerful about what they did was they were keeping these traditional songs in circulation, circulating them around the community where they would otherwise be perhaps lost or forgotten about because, you know, we're removed from that context. So the main singer, Ilona Dunho, she is such an incredible singer. She was really inspired by a lot of these folk traditions that exist within our community and wanted to bring that to life with a new blend of sounds. Gudi be maya nebgani hai gudi Gudi be maya nebgani hai gani Sharshi She
sounds that we heard there include the kanun, the zither, and also the Armenian duduk.
Yes, and it's interesting you call it an Armenian duduk.
Is it not?
Well, it's deeply tied to that region, absolutely. And I mean, I say this as an Armenian as well. Yes. So when I hear it growing up, I'd hear the duduk and I'd be like, oh my God, that's so Armenian. But like a lot of instruments in that region, they were picked up and used by different communities and kind of imbued with their own expressions as well. So definitely there is a really rich Armenian tradition there, but there are different ways of playing these instruments that express, you know, Assyrianness, Armenianness, Balkanness, the various kinds.
You're listening to The Music Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Andrew Ford, and my guest today is artistic researcher and ABC Top 5 arts resident Lolita Emmanuel. We should talk more about collaboration, Lolita. Your work with other Assyrian artists is important. We should mention again Dicky Barto, the filmmaker whose art accompanies the music in your lecture recital film. And then there's also your work with Susan Eskander and the late Nuri Eskander. Could you tell us about Nuri Eskander?
Nuri, yeah. Malfono, Nuri, Malfono also means master or teacher. He was an incredibly, incredibly special person for me. I've always wanted to meet him since the beginning of my project, and I particularly met him at a time where I was thinking a lot about loss and just how much loss there is in our community. I'd just come back from Iraq, and I'd heard stories from many Assyrians who are still reeling with the effects of genocide and the impacts of ISIS. And also I'd seen how some of our traditions were no longer being practiced. I felt this really great sense of urgency. It's that urgency that made me say to my supervisors, look, guys, I know you're super frustrated with me, like constantly going around the world, but I need to do this. I had an opportunity to go to Sweden, which is where Nuri Skanda lives. Nuri was a pioneer of many styles of music. He was known for developing Syrian national music, but he also dedicated his whole life to continuing and showing the world the rootedness of Syriac hymn, Assyrian folk, and many, many different regional expressions to the history of Syria. So he was a musicologist as well and spent so much time studying and understanding and documenting so many traditions. So for me, he held the key to so many answers that I had. And what was so special about meeting him is that he showed me this possibility of performing or experiencing Assyrianness at my non-traditional instrument. And that's because he was really experimental with what he did. He was seen as like a progressivist. He worked and is connected to the tradition of the Syriac Orthodox Church, which for a very long time didn't allow instruments in the church because it was seen as something that would interrupt the emotional experience. But he really wanted to take those sounds and experiment with them with polyphony and in kind of elaborated forms and just show the world of a tradition that he was so proud about. So we met and it was this moment where it was kind of like, where have you been? You know, because he was also looking for someone who was interested in experimenting with this way. You know, some people don't want to use piano at all in our various traditions. But, you know, for me, it was important as a way to express myself at my instrument. So at the very end of our first meeting, he took a puff of his cigarette and he was like, he's like, you know what? I'm going to compose a composition for microtonal piano and violin and you are going to premiere it with my daughter. And I was like so emotional when he said that because, I said to him, you have no idea how much that means to me. That was in 2023. We spoke in December of that year about, you know, how we would do this project. And, you know, he was 89 years old at the time. And I remember him saying, if there's one thing that I do before I die, it's going to be this. And I got off that call thinking, oh my God, I need to go now. A week later, on Christmas Day, he passed away, which was so devastating. But his daughter, Salsan Iskander, she is an incredible, incredible violinist. His daughter and I said, we have to continue this. We have to honor his legacy. We have to continue this project. And so I went to Sweden the next year to his house where we looked through a whole pool of handwritten drafts. It was amazing. It was kind of like, this is what I mean about detectives, right? Musicians being detectives. We were like searching for all these clues and looking at these drafts that were kind of like artifacts, you know, of Assyrian heritage. And we used this Machiano, which was really exciting. And we had to complete these drafts because unfortunately he couldn't start the project that we had wanted to do. But he had written polyphonic music for two instruments, not the piano, but it required us to really get experimental with how we complete those.
But this was in the spirit of Iskander, this being experimental, wasn't it?
That was like the shining light, like his bravery and his experimental spirit. Even though there were so many moments we're in like a practice room and we'd be looking at this penciled in half flat or maybe flat or something. And I'd be like, what is that? And Selsun would say, oh, what? Like, surely Baba wouldn't do that. And so it wasn't just about us trying to interpret like a composer's score. Yes, it was about trying to interpret Malfono Nuri's score. But in a way, I feel like it reflected this constant experience of searching that us as Assyrians do, where we're trying to understand, like, how did our ancestors do it? You know, what did they do before? How did they create that beautiful magic? And how can we do that today?
On today's music show, I'm talking to Lolita Emmanuel about the music of Assyria, but also specifically music of Nuri Iskander, we just heard there. So what was that?
This was Sumsomo, which means literally means fast the fast, the hymn from the Syriac Orthodox Church that's usually sung during Lent, like in Easter. And it's basically encouraging people to fast. And there's a really interesting story behind this song. When the Assyrian Empire was going through that period of Christianization, some of the early hymn writers had to find a creative way to encourage people basically to convert to Christianity. And so they looked at the dance music and the traditional music and the pagan music of that time, and they were like, I'm going to take this melody and set it to religious texts. So there's this really interesting kind of folk element to the hymns, which many Assyrians will say to you, when you listen to our songs, our church songs, it sounds like something that you want to dance to. But, you know, if you look at the text, sometimes they're really like melancholic, really sorrowful, serious liturgical themes. But this was an idea that we were interested in exploring. And so you'll hear us trying to take these sacred hymns, which I should also say was incredibly sensitive too, because many people have a very deep connection to that music. And because we're displaced people and the church and that music is one of the few ways that the community can connect, it kind of felt like we were tampering with culture and tampering with this evidence of history. So this wasn't a perfect experiment. It was our exploration of Sumsomo.
The other place that you can connect is the internet.
I like to say Assyrians are chronically online. Yeah, we have been using the internet as a shared space to come together and exist as a community since the 90s. And music plays a very big role in how we actually connect on there. You know, it's not uncommon to find Assyrians on YouTube videos, connecting with others. Just as an example, the other day I was writing my thesis and I'm, you know, taking a break. And as you do, I opened Instagram. And the first thing I saw was an Instagram story filmed in the village of Dure, which is an Assyrian village in northern Iraq. And I saw a group of Assyrians dancing to an a cappella voice. You know, someone was singing. And the camera panned down to a phone or an iPad or something, amplified by a speaker. And the phone was on a Facebook audio call with an Assyrian singer in the US, basically singing to this group of Assyrians who were dancing to his voice, which was just like so Assyrian, so chronically online. But I think this is a really beautiful thing. It was like me here in Sydney on Instagram, you know, listening to a singer who was originally from Syria, but moved to the US, singing to Assyrians in Iraq. Like, this is what I mean by transnational joinery.
Yes. So what should we finish by listening to, Lolita?
Well, I wanted to show an example of a performance by an incredible, incredible Assyrian musician who's also been a really important mentor for me in my project. His name is Ivan Yakul. He's from Iraq originally, but he's based here and he's a jazz drummer. And what he's done is taken the sounds of rawe and experimented that, reassembled that in a really creative way in a jazz rendition. Yeah, this was one of the first Assyrian concerts that has ever been staged at the Sydney Opera House, which is something that we're all so proud about.
Thank you very much for coming on The Music Show and sharing this wealth of information, almost none of which I had any idea about before.
Likewise, thank you so much. Great to chat.
Rahway. That's Evan Yako performing at the Sydney Opera House. And it's the end of our conversation with Lolita Emmanuel, artistic researcher and ABC Top 5 Arts resident. You can find Lolita's work online, her lecture recital Performing Assyrianness, which looks at lots of the things that we've touched on today, is on YouTube, and there'll be a link at our website. And Lolita's collaboration with Susan Eskander that we spoke about is out in early December, so keep out an eye or ear. The music show is produced by C. Benedict and Ellie Parnell. Technical production from Tim Jenkins and Simon Branthwaite. They're all of them on Gadigal land. I'm on Gundungurra country. Coming up on the music show, you remember our middle of the air competition? Well, we have our winners, two of them, in fact, and their words have been set to music by Leah Senior and Dobby. So tune in for the big reveal.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.